This is a special bonus edition of Judaism Unbound. Judaism Unbound meets history in the Bible. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson, and I'm excited to share with you this special episode. It's a conversation between me and Gary Stevens, the host of the History in the Bible podcast, which is one of my favorite podcasts. It comes out every 2 weeks, generally, and it has gone through the entire story of the Bible, looking at it through a historical, critical lens that really brings some of the most interesting discoveries of modern archaeology and thinking and critical study to the story of the Bible. It's a great way to learn what's in the Bible and also to think about it from the perspective of modern scholarship. Gary is not a professional Bible scholar, very much like us. He is just someone with a lot of curiosity and a lot of interest who has applied his thinking and his curiosity to this particular topic. I love listening to the podcast. It just concluded its first season, and it brought it up to the Babylonian exile, and very soon it's going to start its second season looking at the period from the Babylonian exile through the New Testament. So our conversation touched on the Bible and also other dimensions of our work on Judaism Unbound and of mutual interest, and I'm excited to share it with you.
Hello, I'm Gary Stevens, and welcome to the History in the Bible podcast. All the history, in all the books, in all the Bibles. In today's bonus episode, I'm in conversation with special guest Dan Liebenson of Judaism Unbound. Well, hi, Dan. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, Gary. It's great to be on again. Great to be with you.
And how is sunny Chicago these days?
It's not bad. It's. I've been told that in about 20 years or so, when global warming completely kicks in, Chicago's going to be the new Bay Area, the new San Francisco. So I'm looking forward to that. I mean, it's inevitable.
Yeah, it's inevitable.
But actually, before I moved to Chicago, I lived in Minnesota, which is actually even colder. So I think I'm one of the few people that moved to Chicago for the weather.
Anyway, you are one of the founders of the Judaism Unbound site and podcast. Can you tell us what's that about? And I have some questions about that for you.
Well, so what Judaism Unbound is about, I would say, is we're trying to sort of run down this big idea or this big question, which is, if the future of Judaism is going to look profoundly different from the past of Judaism, what would the process of getting from here to there look like? And what would be some of the core ideas, both that the new Judaism might be built around, and or what might be some of the key ideas that are about the process of getting from here to there? And one of the things that we do on our podcast is that we interview a lot of people that are sort of thinking along the edges of these questions. I mean, a lot of people aren't exactly phrasing it the way that I just did, because it's a pretty radical way to put it. But a lot of people are thinking along those lines, whether they're fully conscious of it or not. A lot of people are trying things out along those lines, whether they're fully conscious of it or not. And we're trying to look around and figure out who's doing that work, who's doing that thinking, and talk to them. And then my co-host Lex and I try to talk about the interviews that we've done every three or four episodes and try to develop this big idea over time. And one of the reasons why I've been especially interested in the Bible has been because I kind of think that the Bible, many parts of the Bible, either mythically talk about this idea of transitioning from one state of being to a new state of Jewish being, and or take place during these key historical moments when that happened. Again, whether the Bible is explicit about it or not. And one of the great things about modern biblical criticism, I think, is that it sort of dug into some of the material and actually helped us see some of those historical moments of transition, which has been really exciting to me to discover and then to try to learn from, both by positive example and by negative example.
Right, because traditional Jewish thought holds that it's all just one unbroken tapestry, doesn't it? Going back to basically Abraham and then Moses, and that nothing has changed.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, traditional commentaries often would sort of retroject things from their present into that past. And so, you know, one of the key examples of that is that in essentially what's modern Judaism, meaning the Judaism of the last 2,000 years, rabbinic Judaism, refers to Moses as Moshe Rabbeinu, which means Moses our rabbi. So they sort of imagine Moses to have been a rabbi thousands of years before any such concept existed. And, you know, there's a lot of that, you know, and over the years that there are commentators, traditional commentators, that if you really dig into them, you see that they didn't really believe that and they were more sophisticated than that. But for whatever reason, that was the accepted way to talk, as if it had been one big unbroken chain. And actually, I think a lot of people absorbed that and believed it. And a lot of people still sort of believe it or think that way and think that it's actually very not true to the Jewish tradition to sort of imagine radical changes. But one of my friends put it very beautifully when she said, you know, Judaism has been reinvented from the time it was invented.
Yes, exactly. That's what I would have thought. I mean, there's been many great ruptures, hasn't there? Everything from the beginning of the monarchy is a rupture. The end of the monarchy is another huge rupture. The time of Ezra, and then the reinvention by the rabbis. I mean, it seems clear to me it's gone through several very different stages. And each time it's come out different, but it's proved to be a very robust and strong religion, hasn't it? I mean, it's still around. You don't find the Hittites still worshipping.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's sort of the key thing about Judaism. I mean, the key sort of mystery is, what is it about this thing that allows it to reconstruct itself after each of these disasters? And I don't know that it's anything metaphysical, but if there's any sort of unbroken chain, anything that I feel sort of motivated to keep going, it's actually this ability to rebuild and this idea that, you know, that we can actually build something profoundly different and then retell the story that it's an unbroken chain. I mean, that it actually may be one of Judaism's secrets of success has been that ability to retell the story as if it has been an unbroken chain, even when it so clearly wasn't, sort of myth-making ability.
Would you say that through the past 2,000 years, Jewish, what would you call it, the establishment, has been more accepting, or at least less murderous, of people who do make some fundamental questions? And I ask that in the sense of, for example, the first Western European scholar to question the existence of Jesus lived in the 1780s. And he wrote a book about it, but he only allowed it to be published after his death because he didn't want to, you know, be hanged as a heretic or something. And that's as late as the 1780s. Christians until the Reformation have been fairly reluctant to take on major questioning. So would you say that Judaism in general has been more amenable to that?
It's a good question. I'm not sure. I mean, in part, I'm not sure because there has been a good job of papering over some of those times, right? So I suspect, yes. I mean, meaning I suspect that it has happened and that it happened quite a few times in Judaism. And I'm so curious to go in a time machine and see what it was during those times. So, you know, there are some key folks that are whose, you know, memories are preserved, for example, in the Talmud, people that lived both in sort of the first or second century, and then also people who lived more in the fourth century. And then there's Maimonides from the Middle Ages, and all of whom raise serious questions about the traditional ways of thinking and the traditional ways that things were done. But the way that we have those questions preserved today is not quite as sort of aggressive as you could imagine that they might have been, or like this Christian thinker that you're talking about, or I think of Spinoza on the Jewish side, who really very explicitly questioned some of these basic principles. And, you know, Spinoza didn't fare all that well in the Jewish community. He was excommunicated. And so I don't really think that it was it's been such a story of acceptance of dissent and of new ideas, so much more so, let's say, than Christianity. But maybe there have been some moments, and maybe it was actually quite common but not talked about. And I wonder if that was also true in Christianity. I mean, do you know anything about the sort of quiet history of Christianity on subjects like that?
No, I'm not an expert on the history of Christianity, I must admit. Christianity seems to have been fairly fractious. I mean, I'm thinking of some major movements in the Middle Ages, like the Bogomils and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And they were slapped down big time, and the history has preserved that. Are you suggesting maybe there was some, shall we say, unpleasant incidents maybe in the Middle Ages or something in Judaism, and they've been quietly disappeared.
Yeah, or I don't know. You know, I sort of, in some of my experiences, even in modern times and even in contemporary times, you kind of come to realize that there's a certain public conversation that among sort of the leadership class that's very much doctrinaire and about these sort of philosophical points, and that's kind of, you know, debating topics, but not really debating that those core deep beliefs. And then often you sort of talk to the regular people and they don't really share those beliefs. They don't really even know those philosophies and understand them or really care much about them. And I sort of suspect that there are some people in between, right, who kind of are more like the common people, right? They have some skepticism. They don't really sort of buy into all this stuff, but they also are more educated and they've got some ideas of their own. And you see that happening in the world today. And I sort of suspect that a lot of what we see happening in the world today has always happened, not only in Judaism, but, you know, meaning I think that people were smarter and more sophisticated in the past than we give them credit for. And so you wonder what was going on. And then again, you know, there are characters in the Talmud, like there's a very interesting character who's sort of one of the heroes of the Talmud named Rava, which in Aramaic means the rabbi. And there's stories where, you know, my friend B'nai Lappi, who's a Talmud scholar who's been on our show a few times, tells about this story where essentially it was a question of what happens if a husband dies or might have died and they don't know. And, you know, he had given his wife a conditional divorce when he set off on this long journey. And then we don't know if he died or not. And the wife is sort of reluctant to enforce this divorce or what to do. And this Rabbi Rava says, we enforce the divorce, meaning we free the wife. She's got to go on and live her life. And the other rabbis are scandalized. You know, they say that, you know, the Bible says that if another man marries a married woman, it's adultery, and you're going to now take this chance that it's adultery, you know, just in order to sort of help people. And he says, yes, you know, just a simple yes. So this is somebody who's not of the school that, you know, whatever says in the Bible, we have to follow exactly. Right. And so there's a lot of that over the years. And I don't know how it was recognized at its time. And I really wonder in the 1500 years or so that passed in between, it was not recognized as radical by the traditional Jewish world. Instead, they found all sorts of ways to sort of change exactly the meaning of what he was saying so that it actually sort of fit in with this very traditional approach. And so I just think, whether intentionally or not, a lot of the dissent has been covered up. And I wonder if that's just universally true in all religions and all civilizations.
It probably is, I suppose. Given that we have a lot of evidence in medieval Christianity for radical dissent, maybe the Europeans just had better historians or
ones who were willing to put down these facts or the documents survive, because the church was great at documenting things, wasn't it? I mean, and it had no hesitation saying, yep, we killed all those Bogomils because they hate God, and here's all the details. So maybe they were just better documenters.
Yeah, and I really think about the time that really is just being talked about on History in the Bible, right? This time of the end of the Kingdom of Judah, where, you know, if you read the Bible as a kind of traditional reader, then you read the Bible to be advocating for this particular monotheistic religion that was commanded from the time of Moses, and everybody should have been observing it for all that time, and they kept sort of sinning. But when you really look at the history, you see that that idea of what Judaism should look like, or what Israelite religion should look like, was there for so little time, right? It was actually the opposite of what it appears to be, right? It was not that this was the religion that should have been observed and there were a lot of sinners. It was actually, this was the minority upstart religion that actually kind of failed at first. And it's just sort of not the way that the society looked at that time for the next 2,500 years. So I think that's the story. That's the common story, is that these times of dissent and disagreement have just been sort of somehow not read that way anymore. And then that not reading it that way becomes the traditional reading.
One of the things that I found interesting going through the archaeology of ancient Israel is how incredibly fractious it is, working out just what happened. And you find there are whole schools of scholarship, both biblical scholarship and archaeologists, who basically accept the Bible as true and, for example, deny that there was anything like polytheism in ancient Israel. So, for example, where we find all these little Asherahs, little stone statues of the goddess Asherah, if you're a type 1 archaeologist, you say, well, okay, we found these things, and that's obviously evidence of a non-Jewish community living in Israel or Judah. Tick. Mm-hmm. Other archaeologists say, no, wait a minute. You are presuming that the Jews have always been monotheists, and you are assuming that fact. Whereas we should be saying, well, hang on, maybe they were polytheists, and we have these statues to prove it. So they're taking logically, diametrically opposite stances. And I think it's almost impossible to resolve them in a sense. One camp says, you are making this huge assumption. The other camp says, no, this is a perfectly reasonable assumption. Or it's like with pig bones. Apparently, pig bones are found in some places in Israel and Judah. One camp says, okay, by definition, where we find the pig bones, we don't find Jews. They must be someone else. And the other camp says, again, hang on a minute, you're making this huge assumption. So there are these endless arguments.
Right. Although it's interesting with the Asherah, it's one of those things where once you start to find them, and then you actually look in the Bible, and you actually notice that the Bible has talked quite a bit about Yahweh and his Asherah. And, you know, it turns out that it was actually there hiding in plain sight, but traditional commentary would find some other way to explain what it's about and what it is. And even translations would, I think, translate Asherah not as a proper name of a goddess, but as some kind of special pole. The whole sort of idea that it was another goddess was lost or intentionally covered up. And then when you do the archaeology and you find it and you go back to the reading, you see actually, wow, it was actually there all along. To me, the problem with biblical archaeology is that there are, you know, a number of types of archaeologists with very contemporary motivations to why they're doing that work. You know, some of them are trying to prove the Jewish approach to the Bible correct. Some of them are trying to prove the Christian approach to the Bible correct. Some of them are trying to prove various things about modern political disputes. And then there are some scholars who are just doing it for scholarly academic interest, but that's just one group out of four or five others. And they're all sort of lumped into the same category of scientific endeavor, right? And that's part of it too. How do you, and that said, just because somebody is motivated by not quite pure motivations doesn't mean that what they're finding isn't actually there. So how do you look at the findings of somebody who is motivated by an extraneous motivation, but nevertheless found some stuff?
Yes, it must be a lot easier investigating, say, Mesopotamian religions where there are no vested political interests hanging around. And I love the way that all the different camps hurtle the ultimate insult of, you are not being objective. And they just point fingers at each other and saying, you're a subjective bastard and you're doing this all wrong. I am objective. And you go, oh, really? Okay.
Right. So how did you get into looking at this stuff, right? Like, this is not your background academically.
No, not at all. My background academically is first in architecture, then in computing, and then in sociology. I've been interested in the Bible since I was a little kid, really. I just found it quite fascinating. And I went to an Anglican high school, and Anglicanism is that most tea and crumpets of religions. I think you call it mostly harmless, as they say in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Bible. But again, it meant I had a constant, vaguely religious education, which stimulated my readings into the Bible. And I've been reading sort of popular works, would you say, ever since I was about 15 years old, popular critical works. That matured over the years, and I started reading more and more. And then one day I thought, well, I'm really interested in this sort of stuff. So why don't I start a podcast? Because I just heard about podcasts about 3 or 4 years beforehand, and I thought, gee, I could do this. And I also thought, I have been an academic, I have given lectures, and I know how to do research. So I could do it up to a certain standard. Obviously, I can't do it up to a postgraduate standard. But I thought, well, I can probably provide enough information to be at an undergraduate standard, what do you call it, freshman, sophomore year sort of thing, but make it not entirely as dry as professors would do. So I just thought, okay, let's give it a go. And I'm an IT contractor. I often have a lot of downtime on my hands. So this was also one way for me to fill in my time. And as you probably know, making a podcast isn't that expensive. You need just sort of decent
audio equipment, the services, the web hosting and the podcast hosting, that's not expensive. It'd be a lot cheaper, I think, than belonging to a moderately upper-class golf course and buying golf clubs.
Right. Although probably the same investment of time.
Oh, yeah. The time investment's huge, isn't it?
And those golf people spend a lot of time golfing.
They certainly do. I think our efforts are done to a better end.
Seems like walking along the golf course is actually a really good time to listen to podcasts.
Actually, that'd be a great time to listen to podcasts. Yeah, that'd be cool. So yeah, I was keen to get out a populist podcast because I thought that a lot of people who might be interested in this sort of stuff simply have absolutely no idea, just on a simple level. How many Christians would know that there were two kingdoms, Israel and Judah? I'll bet a lot of people don't know that.
Yeah, I don't think too many Jews know that either.
As an example of confusion, I was talking to some fairly, what would you call it, ardent Baptists the other day, and I said that I had this really great commentary on the New Testament called the Jewish Annotated New Testament. And it's a recent work out of Oxford University Press, and it is a bunch of modern Jewish scholars writing their commentary on the New Testament. And I must admit, I found it an excellent book. But they stared at me and they said, "We didn't know that the Jews had the New Testament." And I said, no, they don't have the New Testament. And I repeated the explanation, and they still didn't get it. So I was trying to get rid of those sort of things, and I must admit I've been having a lot of fun doing it. I'm getting up to the New Testament. Actually, that won't be until January next year. Well, I found that I've got 5 or 6 episodes just on Leaving Babylon. I didn't think it had stretched that far, but I've had a lot of fun with the Old Testament. And now that I've done all my note-taking for the New Testament, I think the Old Testament's a lot more fun, actually, to look at.
There are more stories. Is that why?
There are more stories. It's older, so that makes it murkier, like we know less.
Mm-hmm.
There is confusion in the sources. The editorial process is obscure. It has more mysteries. I think that's the best way to put it. It has more and deeper mysteries.
I mean, also, the New Testament was basically written over a much shorter period of time.
Yeah.
There's this sort of compression of time, I think, in the Old Testament that makes it interesting and also makes it there a lot to pull apart and to really understand the history and what's really going on and who are the, you know, whereas the New Testament is really a lot of writings from a much more constricted period of time.
And the sources we can posit for the New Testament are simpler to disentangle, I think. Whereas I sort of like the mystery behind the sources in the Old Testament. I mean, a lot of the authors or the schools will be lost forever to time, really. And yeah, like you, I'd like to take a time machine and go back and actually sort of go to the scribes and say the late time of the kingdom of Judah and say, oh, okay, you really were writing this stuff. Now, where did you get your information from?
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask you, like, do you feel like having really done this deep dive into it and really, I think like what you've done that's so special and amazing and something that I haven't really seen anywhere else is kind of organizing it all and, you know, for lay people and making it sort of clear what happened when, and, you know, you've got all the timelines on your site and everything, but even just making it clear, like, what were the politics that were going on, you know, and I loved how you sort of pulled apart Isaiah as a kind of political advisor versus a prophet talking about God and, you know, all the different things that are going on. And I was wondering if you can picture all this in your mind's eye, or it's still for you just figuring out stuff about a written work, but you don't really fully wrap your mind around what was it really like there? Where were these people? What were they actually doing all day? You know, or do you feel like you've gotten inside of that?
No, I don't think I've gotten inside of that any more than I can get inside, say, the mind of a modern Jew, in the sense that I haven't lived the life, like stuff which you would take for granted. Daily life, I would have absolutely no idea. Like I only found out about the Omer period when I was just listening to your podcast.
Oh, Omer.
Uh-huh. Omer, which corresponds to the Christian season of Easter. Christians listening, Easter does not stop on Easter Sunday. It goes for another 7 weeks after.
Till Pentecost. Mm-hmm.
So the seasons pretty much correspond exactly. But I didn't know that that existed as a particular count of weeks in Judaism. So in that sense, no, I've got absolutely no idea what was going on in their heads. The best I can do is sort of get an impression, I suppose, with the aid of all these scholars. And that's one thing that struck me. Had I actually done more reading, I would never have started this thing. Mm-hmm. In the sense that, I mean, people devote their whole lives
to researching tiny little, like the book of Jeremiah. You could get a whole career out of that, couldn't you?
Absolutely. I think many people have. But that's actually one of the ideas that we've developed on our podcast over time, is that there's a kind of a curve of what we plotted it as knowledge versus chutzpah, which, you know, is the Yiddish word that kind of means having the nerve to do something, you know, the audacity. And that sometimes if you have no knowledge, then you're not going to have the audacity to do anything too interesting because you're too intimidated by the fact that you don't know anything. But often as you acquire knowledge, you get to a certain place where you all of a sudden realize this is so vast that there's no way that I could ever acquire all the knowledge, and you go into sort of an analysis paralysis and you don't do anything either. And so I think like the sweet spot of just feeling like you've kind of collected enough information, or you have something that makes you bold enough to say, you know, I'm just going to go and get started on this. That's really where creative work happens. And for me, the kind of the regret and the wish, you know, that I'd like to see in the Jewish world is that, you know, I'd like to see more people living in that sweet spot. You know, I think most Jews, most American Jews, feel too intimidated by their lack of knowledge to really contribute their creative ideas, even though they might have them. And then you have the leadership class, rabbis, et cetera, who go to school for many, many years, and they become taught and conditioned to not rock the boat too much. And so you have some people in that middle space, but I really want there to be more. And I feel like I'm so fascinated by what you have been doing with this, with your podcast, because it's an example of what I would really be excited if more people were doing. Actually, there's another new podcast that just started recently by somebody who's actually a television writer in California, and it's called The Bad Jew Weekly. But it's the same thing. Like, she has the nerve to say, you got something to contribute to this conversation. And we just want to see more and more of that. You know, we feel like people do have what to say. And yeah, they should study and they should accumulate some knowledge, but not necessarily as much as other people tell them they need to have in order to really make a contribution.
Oh, yeah. Actually, just on that, sometimes when I've had a tricky question, oh boy, have I been slapped down. It's a case of, I say, you know, I'm doing this podcast, I'd like to know about this. And some of the responders are quite nice. Others say, look, mate, you've got no idea. You don't speak Hebrew. Forget about it. And you're thinking, well, that's nice and encouraging. Thank you very much.
Right. Well, and that makes me think of, you know, I have not done a PhD in Jeremiah, you know, but I've been thinking about Jeremiah a little, because in the upcoming sort of readings in the synagogues, some readings from Jeremiah are coming up. And we were actually interviewed on this Bad Jew Weekly podcast recently talking about Jeremiah. And I actually think that Jeremiah is sort of living in a time in some ways similar to ours, in the sense that it's kind of a state of collapse. I mean, I'm talking about the Jewish world, but I think the same could be said for our Western democracy world, at least here in America. And, you know, he's kind of looking at these leader, or, you know, the first leader, especially Josiah, that he lived on, which, you know, one group of people is lionizing, but he's seeing him making these horrible geopolitical decisions. And what does he do? But I feel like that's where it feels to me like Jeremiah tried to get the kings to do something different. They didn't listen to him. But then he sort of tries to reassure the people, like, just kind of, you know, you're going to go off to exile, but settle in, things will turn around. You know, it's kind of gives them some solace. But I wish that this sort of middle ground that we're talking about had existed, or was sort of on his mind. And maybe actually that's what happened in exile. You know, I really wonder about what was going on during the Babylonian exile, and who took up control, right? Or, you know, who were the creative people that really said, hey, let's kind of rethink all this? You know, were they the elites of the elites, or were they maybe that sort of second tier, the people that were more creative and a little less elite, but that the elites had been booted out, so there was some freedom to be creative that there hadn't been before the exile, something like that.
Yeah, the exile's very interesting, isn't it? Because there's not much information directly about it, and yet it seems
right,
to be
very
quite,
little.
Yeah, quite profound. Now, am I correct in saying that the names of the months in the Jewish calendar are Babylonian?
Yeah, correct.
I mean, now that's something. If you construct a calendar and the names come from another culture, that must indicate a profound influence. In the same way that in English, the names of our months come from Latin, but the days of the week come from German. So that indicates two major influences. So given that
they took the names of the months from there. What else did they take? And that seems to be largely invisible, doesn't it?
Well, yes and no, right? I mean, I think that one thing that they took was the Aramaic language, which you know, for, I think that most Jews think that in the Second Temple period, these Jews were all running around speaking Hebrew, but they weren't. They were speaking Aramaic, and the elites were still writing in Hebrew, as they have throughout Jewish history. But then in the post-destruction period, right, after the destruction of the Second Temple, all of the Jewish literature is in Aramaic. So they, or most of the Jewish literature is in Aramaic. And what's funny is that in the Jewish world, like if you ask, if you know, if somebody really thinks really hard about it, they might give you a different answer. But if you ask, you know, sort of your average Jew who even knows anything about what language things are in, and you ask them about Aramaic, they'll kind of talk as if Aramaic is a Jewish language. That's how they think of it. The Talmud is written in Aramaic. It's like Yiddish. Like that's the Jewish language that the Talmud is written in, and Yiddish was the Jewish language that we spoke in Eastern Europe. And you know, obviously, the complete opposite is the case, right? I mean, Aramaic was the English of its day, and really all that, whatever happened with all the invasions, I guess the Islamic invasions replaced it with Arabic, right? And it was basically lost. And the only place that it was, or one of the only places that it was preserved was by the Jews in the Talmud, but it was in no way a Jewish language. I think that there's a lot of that, you know, and that there's just tremendous amount of stuff that is part of that is, you know, seen as Jewish, but the only reason that it's really seen as so profoundly Jewish is that the other cultures that it was really profound in have disappeared. And as we start to do some archaeological finds in Mesopotamia, for example, I think what's really interesting is to find, and not really talked about that much by lay people because they don't really know, is how much of what has been found in Mesopotamia actually seems pretty similar to elements that had been thought of as fundamentally Israelite before by lay people.
Now, on Hebrew, would you say that it is therefore probably correct to say that right from the time of the return through to the formation of the State of Israel, the status of Hebrew was mainly as a liturgical language, like, say, Latin?
Absolutely. Or, you know, and maybe we could say as a scholarly language, also like Latin, right? That, so not, I would say not only liturgical, but liturgical and scholarly.
Right. So the only times that Hebrew became a living language again, right from the time of the destruction of Judah by the Babylonians, was only in 1947.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of the state, I mean, the revival of Hebrew as a spoken language was part of the Zionist enterprise. It was earlier than 1947, but it was in the late 19th century. But yeah, I mean,
oh, I see.
Pretty much. And, you know, I think that it's funny because I think that most Jews will acknowledge that was the case from the destruction of the Second Temple on. But I think that they'd be surprised to learn that it was really true from the destruction of the First Temple on, the first king, the first Commonwealth, whatever we call it, the Kingdom of Judah.
I remember, I think a couple of years ago, maybe 2 years ago, the Pope and the Israeli Prime Minister, what's his name again?
Netanyahu.
Bibi, is that what he's called?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's his nickname.
The Pope said, they were standing next to each other, and the Pope was saying that, and Jesus spoke Aramaic, and Bibi pipes up, and Hebrew.
Yeah, what's interesting is that I think Bibi was wrong, right? I mean, yeah. Jesus didn't speak Hebrew, nor did any of the Jews around him. You know, that's the thing, right? It's and again, I think that's a great example of, again, I don't think it's only a Jewish thing, but it's definitely very much a Jewish thing is this, what we were talking about, the sort of retrojection of present realities back into history and doing so very effectively. There are other interesting things like this. So, for example, the word Torah in Hebrew means teaching or law, perhaps, depending on how you... essentially, it comes from the root of teach. So when you say, this is my Torah, it means this is my teaching. So the Bible, the Old Testament, is full of the word Torah. And the five books of Moses, the Pentateuch, came to be called the Torah at one point, right? The teachings. But then over time, it became the title of this book. So the five books of Moses effectively has acquired the title Torah. And you know, now in English, that's just translated as Bible. So then when you go and you look in at what's written in this Torah, right, it talks a lot about the Torah. People sort of misread that to say the Torah is talking about itself or about the Bible. But no, what it means in the Torah is teachings. And there's so much of that. Bible talks a lot about the ger, which is the word that the Bible uses for the stranger. It comes from the root of reside, to live in a place. And so it talks a lot about the stranger. And there's the Bible is full of saying, you know, because you were slaves in Egypt, you should care for the stranger, because you were strangers in a foreign land. But in rabbinic Hebrew, the word ger came to mean a convert. So then in traditional reading of the Bible, it's as if the Bible is actually talking about converts. So it's saying, you know, you shouldn't oppress converts, but strangers, sure, you know, go ahead, because it only says don't oppress converts. That's rife with that. And I think that that's, you know, I'm sure equally true in Christianity and in other religions and in other cultures, you know, is that these words sort of take on new meanings. And then people go back and read the old text and they think that it means the modern definition of these words. And that's caused a lot of problems. That over the course of Jewish history, there have been a lot of fundamentalists who have imagined that the Bible says that it's okay to treat foreigners badly, because all it says is you shouldn't treat converts badly. That gives them license to do some pretty bad things.
I think in Christianity, possibly the most well-known case would be the passage in Isaiah, which ended up being translated from the Hebrew as virgin in Greek and Latin. But I did a whole little section on this. But in Hebrew, the word means something more like maiden, and maiden in the English sense. I mean, maiden could mean a young girl. Yeah, a young woman. It could mean a virgin, but it mainly means sort of young woman. And even today, apparently the test case for fundamentalists is if their particular translation of the Bible uses the word in Isaiah, virgin, specifically, and they won't take any other sort of translation. Now, I have the New American Bible Revised Edition, which is the official Catholic translation for North Americans. Why North Americans get their own Bible, I don't know, but that's what the Catholics decided. And even in their Bible, they translate it as young woman. But it's taken centuries for that fact to be acknowledged. And you can still find, well, enormous, enormous problems. I mean, in Hebrew, as a Hebrew speaker, I suppose you have the problem of changes of meaning in Hebrew. The problem for Christians who are reading the Greek or Latin is, of course, then you have the translation problem. And often the translation, like in the Septuagint, comes to completely overwhelm the original Hebrew.
Well, I just heard recently about a new translation of the Bible that has come out in Israel to modern Hebrew, right? Because modern Israelis were misreading the Bible, right? Because it was a Hebrew, but it was sort of like, you know, when we read Shakespeare or whatever, you know, half the words we don't really understand. Yeah, I mean, a lot have changed the meanings. A lot, we have no clue what they mean whatsoever. And that's very similar it's a little bit different for a modern Hebrew reader to an ancient Hebrew reader because modern Hebrew is relatively recent creation, and a lot of it was taken directly from ancient Hebrew roots and words. So it's a little bit closer, but still, modern Hebrew over the last 100 years has, like all languages, evolved and diverged, and it's gotten to a point where contemporary Israelis are having a hard time reading the Bible. There was also a great book that I really enjoyed called And God Said. It's a book about translating the Bible by a translator called Joel Hoffman. One of my favorite stories that he talks about is the 23rd Psalm, you know, which we all know, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He says, you know, it's not only an issue of translating the word, it's that a shepherd doesn't mean today what it used to mean back then. So shepherd is the right translation of the Hebrew ro'i. Ro'i does mean my shepherd. But for contemporary people, when they think about what a shepherd is, they think of some kid who's kind of walking like along with some goats and, you know, just kind of making sure they don't get lost. Whereas in the Bible, what a shepherd was, a heroic sort of strong figure whose job it was to protect the flock from mountain lions. And so... Oh. You know, which we see in Samson and David.
So
what the Lord is my shepherd is supposed to mean is the Lord is my protector, is my hero, right? And so he says, you know, a sort of better translation to capture that meaning would be something like the Lord is my lumberjack. You know, that's what it means, like from a visualizing sense. But of course, you could never translate it as the Lord is my lumberjack because it doesn't say that. So what are you supposed to do? You know, and he kind of throws up his hands and he says, you kind of have to translate it as shepherd, but you lose a lot that way.
I don't envy the task of translators. Actually, speaking of that, you're translating something now, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm just about finished with a second novel that I've worked on by the Israeli author Yochi Brandis. We talked about the last one on your show. I was more the translation editor for that one. And this one I've done the translation, and it's about the early rabbis after the destruction of the Second Temple. So it doesn't have a title in English yet, but it hopefully it will be published in the fall. And it's been an amazing education in terms of all sorts of decisions relating to translation. And I don't know if I made the right ones.
Can you give us an example of a typical problem? Because I find this absolutely fascinating. If I was a translator, I'd be pulling my hair out, thinking, yeah, lumberjack. That'd be such a much better image to give. But no, we can't use that. Were there some places where you were just going,
Some of the hard choices that we had to make were when there is a passage quoted from the Talmud, but not quoted because, right, this is talking, a part of the story here is like how sort of certain passages that ended up later in the Talmud, sort of how they got their start, you know, and there are sort of quotations, but they're not quotations from the Talmud because this is taking place before the Talmud is written. So they're kind of just conversation that people are having, but they're using lines from the Talmud, and a Talmud scholar would know that and would kind of say, oh, that was clever. And most people would sort of go over their heads. And so the question becomes, now some of these quotations have kind of come into modern Hebrew as sort of obscure types of quotations, like, you know, methinks thou dost protest too much, you know, that kind of thing from Shakespeare. And you know, people kind of more or less get what the point that you're making is, even if they don't really understand the meaning of those words. And so the Israeli reader would read these and would kind of get it. But if you just translated if you just looked up in the Talmud to see what this was translated as by a usual Talmud translation, it wouldn't have the same experience for the English reader. And then you have to make the decision, you know, do we want to lose for the English reader the fact that this is actually quoting a line that later was in the Talmud, so that, and instead just give it the basic idea of what it means so that they'll follow the story, which is ultimately the important thing. Because if they lose what's going on in the story just in order to preserve the quotation, you know, that doesn't seem to really be in service of the overall mission of the book. And on the other hand, when it's a book about how a text came to be, it seems kind of like a big loss to lose the quotation. So those were some of the challenges that we had. I mean, another interesting one was which Bible translation to use for biblical quotations. And what was interesting was that in the previous book, which was about basically the time of King David, so it was taking place in the biblical period, we actually chose a more modern translation of the Bible for the quotes, because we wanted it to sound contemporary for the characters. Whereas for this book that's about the Talmud, the rabbis of the Talmud, where they would be reading the Bible already as an old book, and for them it would already be kind of archaic language, we actually chose a more archaic translation, the King James, right? Because we wanted it to have the feeling that it was kind of obscure, and that they really had to interpret it, because that was the project of the rabbis. So Those are some of the choices that sort of are most top of mind.
That's very interesting. Yeah, and that does show the complexities of translating these things. Good choice for the King James, though, to show that sort of distance between the period of this new novel and the time of the writings that they're talking about. Now, when I mentioned earlier that I don't know what it's like to be a modern Jew, I don't know what it's like to be a modern Bulgarian, for that matter.
Right.
Or anything like that, because I just haven't lived the life. Now, I've got a quote here about the differences between thinking in Christianity and Judaism. And I'd like to see if you think it rings true or if it's just this guy talking. Now, the quote comes from the Jewish writer and journalist David Plotz, who seemed to work for Slate magazine.
Yeah, I went to college with him.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. Oh, okay. He was a couple of years older than me. I only knew him. I only met him like once or twice, but he was a nice guy.
Okay. Well, David says this in his book, The Good Book, which is a fairly funny commentary on the Bible, and I've used a lot of it and some of his jokes in my own podcast, but I have attributed him. Anyway, he says, "One thing that strikes me about my evangelical Christian friends is that they share Jacob's sense that God is interested in their lives. Like the patriarch Jacob, they feel that God, or Christ, is with them and that he will not leave them until he has done what he promised them. But I don't know any Jews who feel this way. It could be I am friends with the wrong Jews. But the Jews I know don't act or talk as if they have a personal relationship with God. They pray to God and may even feel that God works in the world, but they don't believe that God takes a personal interest in them. I sure don't think he's watching me. Why would he bother? Now, what do you think is a characterization? Is that just David with his own personal feelings, or do you think that's common amongst Jews?
I think it's common amongst Jews, but I do think that there are some Jews that do feel like, I think particularly in the ultra Orthodox world, not everybody, and you know, that's a world that's often very sort of closed, and a lot of us. I mean, that's what a good example of, right? I haven't lived in that world, and I don't really know. But I have a sense from things that I've read that there's more of a sense in that world of Jews that God is more is taking a more, you know, personal interest in people's lives, or they talk to God that way. But I think what David's saying is generally true of most Jews, certainly most non-Orthodox Jews, and I think probably most Orthodox Jews in the world today. But I wonder if But he's comparing that to evangelical Christians. Like, what do you think about the non-evangelical Christians?
Well, I certainly agree with him that, for example, so the Baptists I know would feel that. They would feel that God and Jesus are personally looking over them and are interested in their lives and always will be and always have been. Talking to the Catholic members of my family, it's very much mediated through the church. I think, no, the impression I get from Catholics is not that God and Jesus is personally looking after them. It's the church. The church is interested. The church will look after them. The church will punish them or praise them. And the church is a whole new layer of intermediaries between God and Jesus. And, of course, we introduced Mary into that. So I think that there'd be a difference. If you just look at your average Christmas Christian, a person who only goes to church, maybe Easter, maybe Christmas, that's it. I think there'd be that feeling in general, but mainly in a sort of a praise or punishment sense. You know, it's like God is a schoolmaster who's patrolling the playground and saying, yeah, stop that, Michael, in that sense.
Right. I mean, I think that Jews as a collective, there's a sort of underlying current of having felt you've been hard done by God over the years. And I wonder to what extent that sort of seeped in. There's a thinker named Yitz Greenberg, Rabbi Irving Greenberg, who I really, you know, his theology really speaks to me, although I don't really consider myself a theist. But if I were, or to the extent that I am, his theology really speaks to me, which is that essentially he says, you know, in these different eras of Judaism, God has kept moving away from us. And so in the first era of Judaism, in the temple era, God was imminent and lived among us, and we literally fed him with sacrifices, and he looked over every very, very closely. In the rabbinic period, God took a step further back and, you know, was kind of not really involved anymore in the day-to-day. And so instead of feeding him, we prayed to him. His point is also, and as God moves away, that leaves more responsibility upon human beings. And so it becomes more and more necessary for us to sort of start doing ourselves what God used to do for us. And, you know, it's a version of a child growing up, right? And the parents not being as involved anymore. And his theology was kind of sparked by the Holocaust. You know, he's really a post-Holocaust theologian. And his view of the Holocaust is like, that was the moment when God moved even further away. You know, for whatever reasons, that God is so distant now from the world that basically all of the responsibility is on our shoulders now. And that doesn't mean that God is dead, and that doesn't mean that God doesn't care. And I'm not totally sure what it does mean and how he would think where God is for him exactly, but he's quite distant. Part of what I think that his theology, I mean, part of why I think it speaks to me is because it's not that people are reading him and then saying, oh yeah, you know, that's what I believe, changing the way that they are. It's that I actually think that theology more or less captures what Jews actually think, right? You know, they don't think too much about God for most of the time. Functionally, that means God's pretty far away. I mean, if God were really among us, you know, really looking over us, I mean, I think like if we really had a sense that God was looking that closely, we'd probably take it seriously and go to the synagogue more often, etc. So I think being that we don't, it's a sign those beliefs are not particularly alive. And for me, the challenge then becomes, I don't know, like I'm looking for language for this. I think we jump pretty quickly to the term religion to describe Judaism. it's true that Judaism, I mean, the thing that was ever called Judaism was Rabbinic Judaism. I mean, I don't know what they called it in the Second Temple period, the religion of Israel, you know, and before that, the cult of Judah, you know, I mean, it wasn't called Judaism. Basically, Judaism, Rabbinic Judaism is pretty much a religion, but the Jewish people had an identity and had all kinds of ways of describing themselves before Judaism became a religion. And I can imagine that there might be other ways of thinking about it after it's a religion. Part of, I feel like, the search that I'm on with Judaism Unbound is, you know, is there some other terminology that we could use to sort of describe Judaism that where the religion is optional? And, you know, the Reconstructionist Judaism is a movement that was created in the early part of the 20th century and the middle part of the 20th century that talked about Judaism as a civilization. So it was getting at a similar idea, you know, that Judaism is not a religion. Judaism is a civilization that has a religion. But nevertheless, I think that the idea of religion was still very, very much central, even in Reconstructionism. So it's not necessarily the only descriptor. It's not even necessarily the primary descriptor, but it's an important one. And I kind of think that it for many people, it's objectively not an important one. Nevertheless, they feel powerfully Jewish. So somehow we have to come up with a different way of describing that, and I'm not sure what that is.
That, I suppose, almost answers another question I had for you. Well, maybe not answers, it sort of explores the relationship between being culturally Jewish, say, and religiously Jewish. And you seem to be trying to grasp those issues, because I presume it is possible, you're saying, in effect, to be a Jewish atheist or an atheistic Jew. Is that the best way to describe it? That's perfectly possible.
Yeah, I don't know which one is it, but yeah, but yes. But here's like what I'm trying to figure out is like I think that there's another category that just we don't have the language for yet, or we haven't fully invented yet. Because what many people think when they say a cultural Jew, even when people proudly describe themselves as cultural Jews, they're not really cultural, right? That culture is not especially thick in their lives. It means that they have a Jewish sensibility, you know, then they're in their humor and their relationships. They like hanging out with Jews. They like watching Jewish films, you know, eating Jewish foods. But I don't think that it necessarily means that they are getting real help in living the lives that they want to lead from some form of Judaism. To me, that's what I'm after, right? The Judaism that I'm looking for is, I think, something much more akin to what we might call a wisdom tradition. It plays a lot of the functions in our lives that religion might play in religious people's lives, but it's not focused on something external. But it is more than a culture in that thin way that I think people usually mean it. And so a lot of times, especially the people that sort of really are doing this work, and they say, yeah, that's what culture is. Culture is this thick thing, you know, and I'm like, yeah, I think that's what culture could be at its best. But when people talk about being culturally Jewish, that's generally not what they're talking about. They're generally talking about the thinner version.
Okay. That analogy with the Western tradition, that's very interesting.
Yeah. And what I was sort of thinking about and exploring the idea is that, like, if we think about the religion as kind of the user interface, and that this deeper wisdom, or whatever we want to call it, is the real kernel. Of course, it was going to be put out with a religion user interface in a time when everybody had a religion. And so that would be the best user interface to put out there. But in a time like when we live today, where so many people don't have religion, don't want religion, the question is, can you have a different user interface for that same deeply powerful material that's the real kernel? And how would you go about that? You know, that's sort of what I'm after. And I think more and more people are starting to see that question. And so then it becomes, you know, once we have enough people asking that question, what does the process look like of, you know, rejiggering the kernel so that it really does what we need in our lives, and then remaking the user interface so that people are really able to access it?
I get the strong feeling that you're going to spend the next 20 years working through these things. As you said, you even have to develop the vocabulary to talk about them.
Right. And I, you know, it's funny, when I first went into this Jewish work, but before that, I was actually, like you, I was an academic, but in a completely different line of work. I was a law professor.
Oh, right.
And And I was teaching at a Catholic law school that was struggling over the Catholic nature of its mission. And, you know, I had a sense of what I was hoping that it was going to be. And other folks had a sense of what they were hoping it was going to be. And I actually felt like it would end up being what I was hoping that it was going to be. And I could play a big role in that. But it would be 20 or 30 years until that happened. And that was this moment in my life when I started to feel like, oh, for the first time in my life, I'm thinking about accomplishing something over 20 or 30 years, not for the next year or two. That was when I felt like, okay, well, now I can go back and work in the Jewish world, because I know what I'm looking for is not going to happen in 2 or 3 years, but maybe in 20 or 30. So, you know, if I'm already willing to work for something for 20 or 30 years, I might as well do that. So, yeah, I'm comfortable with that. You know, I've thought a lot about, there's a book called Don't Think of an Elephant by a linguist named George Lakoff, who writes about American politics and why the American Republican Party has been so effective at, you know, in American politics over a long period of time. And one of the things that he talks about is that they've been able to frame the discussions using language that they developed over a long period of time, right? And that they invested in the development of the language and the ideas. And then once they were developed, they deployed them and they were very effective. And so I think that that's probably the way these things go. And actually, I mean, this is sort of one of the things that I'm so curious about with the Bible, right? Because what I'm imagining is that, again, with the compression of time, we think of the Bible as these things happening either not at all or very quickly, these like transitions we were talking about earlier. We think of it as this like unbroken chain. But the reality is that there were probably these kind of very tiny schools of scribes or priests or whoever they were doing a lot of really fundamental rethinking and reworking and writing of texts, which at that time was not an easy process and was very time consuming. And that they probably were working on this stuff for many decades, right? And then something changed geopolitically, or something happened, or a new king came up who they were able to influence. And all of a sudden, like, they were able to really move the ball forward. But it was only because they had invested in the creation of all these ideas and language and stories and everything for so long. And so that's what I really wonder, that is that theory true? Like, could, you know, that's where I'd like to go back in time, not to the necessarily to the dramatic time in which these major changes happen. I'm actually sort of interested in coming to see what was going on like 20 years before that, and to see who those more radicals were that were saying, you know, we're going to get started on this other thing.
Right. Now, one thing, I don't know if I picked this up correctly, but looking at your website and listening to the podcasts, there seems to be a sense of, in Judaism Unbound, there seems to be, I don't know, lurking, is that the word? A sense of worry or concern? Or am I just reading that into things?
It's interesting that I don't know. You know, that is the Jewish community, particularly in America. I mean, worry and concern, I think, is endemic. There was actually a book, I don't know exactly when it was written, but it was something like the Jews, the ever dying people. You know, the Jews are always worried that they're about to disappear. And maybe that's part of the secret of success also. You know, if you're always worrying that you're on the knife edge of a catastrophe, then you're always working really hard to avoid it, maybe less likely to have a catastrophe. I don't know. But you know, it's funny because I'm curious, like, what it is that sort of struck you that way, because it's true that I think that when we started the podcast, we probably were talking some of the language of the entire Jewish community, right? Which is that it's fundamentally, you know, oh, we're dying out. People are not interested anymore. And the crisis is lack of affiliation. And what are we going to do to try to get more people to participate? And I think that over the year and a half that we've been doing the podcast, I've really evolved in my thinking about what the problem is. And I think that the problem is not that people are less and less interested in Judaism, it's that it's less and less clear what the point of Judaism is. What good is it? What is it for? What, you know, what is it there to do? That actually, if we were able to answer those questions in a compelling way, the people would come. So I feel actually a lot less nervous anymore, right? Because I think that that process of figuring out what a Judaism would look like that would be compelling in the next iteration is by definition one that's going to take a long time, that's going to be experimental, that's going to have fits and starts, it's going to have successes and failures. and that it doesn't matter really how long it takes, because once it's found, it'll take off. And if it's not ever found, then it probably didn't really need to exist and didn't really need to exist anymore. So I'm kind of more okay with it.
Just before we go, I just have one question from an email you sent me. You referred to, I think it was a difference between you and Lex in Judaism Unbound, and you referred to a third rail issue. Now, I know what a third rail is in railway technology, but I've got no idea what that idiom means.
Well, what the idiom means in America, at least, is that railroads, there are two rails that the wheels go on, and there's a third rail that supplies electricity to the electrical train.
Yeah, we don't have that here.
Because you don't have electrical trains?
Oh, yeah, we got electrical trains, but they're all overhead wires.
Oh, okay. So, we probably do too in more modern versions, but I think in the original, subways, there is this third rail. The point is that if you touch it, you die, right? Because it's electrified. So, there are topics in the Jewish community, and I think that Israel really is the topic in contemporary Jewish debates that people are sort of afraid to talk about because, it's one of the ones that there's nothing you can say about it that's not going to really make somebody angry. And so you might as well avoid it. And that's what it sort of means by the third rail. But of course, if you avoid it, then you're not really doing much to solve the issue. So it's a challenge. But what's interesting to me is that God is not such an issue. Pretty much you can say whatever you want about God and not everybody's going to agree with you, but they're like, oh, yeah, you're entitled to your opinion. But if you say something about Israel that people don't agree with, you're not entitled to your opinion.
Oh, that's very interesting.
And I think it often comes from existential fears on both sides, right? I mean, I think that one side is afraid of physically dying, right? Like if we make the wrong decisions, if Israel doesn't survive, then a lot of people are going to die. Maybe Jews won't be safe in the world anymore, et cetera. And then the other set of people are also have existential fears that if Israel isn't the kind of society that Judaism stands for, then really Judaism has died, right? Then what's the point of the whole thing? So I actually think part of the reason why it's a third rail issue is because it really feels existential to everybody. And again, I find it fascinating that apparently God is not such an issue for most people.
You've been listening to a conversation with Dan Liebenson, who has embarked on a 20-year journey with his website and podcast, Judaism Unbound. You really should check it out.